You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
The Vice President and Director of the Foreign Policy Program, our President, Strobe Talbott, unfortunately, is in Seattle, Washington, instead of Washington, D.C. today. He's very sorry that he isn't here to welcome President Saakashvili. He instead sent his father and brother to honor the president because, as the president can attest, Strobe and he are good friends for many years. And he sends his apologies and his welcome to you. President Mikhail Saakashvili, known to his friends as Misha, is somewhat of a folk hero, educated first in Tbilisi and then in Columbia University in New York, where he was admitted to the New York bar. He went back to his country, Georgia, took up the cause of human rights, entered parliament in 1995, was appointed Minister of Justice in October 2000, and much of the rest is history. In 2003, he played a catalytic role in what became known as the Rose Revolution. Subsequent to that popular revolution, which brought democracy to Georgia, he was elected in 2004 the president of Georgia at 37 years of age. Since then, he's been re-elected in 2008 as president of Georgia. One thinks back on those events of 2003 in Georgia when watching the dramatic events unfolding today and sweeping across the Middle East from Tunisia and Egypt across to the Gulf. As Georgia has found, and President Saakashvili can attest, the democratic transition is not an easy one. Moving from popular revolution to effective governance that produces a modern democratic state is a complicated process. And so at this time, when the winds of change are blowing across another part of the world, we're delighted to have an opportunity to hear from one who led the Georgian Revolution to discuss how Georgia has tackled these kinds of challenges. Mr. President, we're very glad to have you here. Just before I call you up, I should say Fiona Hill, director of our Center for U.S. and Europe, will be moderating the discussion afterwards. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome President Saakashvili.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. I'm delighted by the honor of speaking here again in the Brookings, which, under our friend Strobe Talbott, has been such a major player in town, but also a very good friend and advisor to us, Georgia. Allow me also, I already thanked Martin Indyk for this introduction, and looking forward to Fiona Hill organizing the discussion and moderate the Q&A session. Engaging with the audience at Brookings is always a pleasure and an intellectual challenge, and I'm looking forward to debating with you. To set the backdrop of our discussion, I wanted to share a few thoughts about an extraordinary development in North Africa and the Middle East in the perspective of our own experience back in Georgia. Ladies and gentlemen, great events in history almost always take part by surprise. They come as surprise to their foes, but also a surprise to their protagonists very often. And those who observe these events from far rarely understand the scope of what is transpiring. Such eruptions in the world politics require from all of us capacity of radical astonishment that Aristotle was putting at the beginning of philosophy and ability to abandon usual schemes. Nobody predicted or planned the revolutions that swept across Eastern and Central Europe in 1989, or a bit further on the East, the colored revolutions that came 15 years later. Now again, as the wave of popular uprisings unfolded in the Middle East, politicians, analysts, and editorial writers all have been utterly surprised. The Tunisian and the Egyptian revolutions inspired among all of us a sense of awe and wonder, and we still look at them without a clear understanding of what really happened, and almost most of all, what will follow. Revolutions have this amazing ability not only to transform the countries in which they take place, but also they force us all to rethink and reshape our vision of the world. I didn't come here, of course, with ready answers to the questions raised by this event. I do not have these answers. I don't think anybody really has them. I came here to explore these questions with you and to share some of the lessons I have drawn from Georgia's own revolutionary transformation. And let's feed the debate. I'm very, very much braced for a lively, interactive debate. What is the experience of Georgia can be relevant to our understanding of the Arab Spring? What can be comparable between a mostly Muslim country of 80 plus million people and a predominantly Christian country of less than 5 million people? And what can we glean from the successes and failures of colored revolutions that will allow us to craft a smarter, more effective approach to North Africa and the Middle East? As most of you know, 7 years ago, less than 7 years ago actually, the revolution, Rose Revolution in Georgia happened in 6 years and 3 months ago. Georgia was a classical failed state. An entrenched bureaucracy was killing an initiative in the society. There was crippling poverty, cynicism, inadequate infrastructure, an economy shackled by corruption. As you know, as well as peaceful popular revolution brought to power a young team of reformers that I happened to lead. The situation back in Georgia was so catastrophic that we had to build our state almost from the scratch. Yet in many ways, this was rather a blessing than a curse. We knew that half steps and overly cautious measures wouldn't be a mere drops in the ocean, an ocean in which Georgia was sinking quickly. We opted the consequence for a radical course that would transform our old nation by the young independent state into a regional laboratory for reforms. And who were we at the time? Nothing more than a group of young men and women from student organizations, opposition parties, and civil society groups. From one day to the next, we were in charge of a fragile country in a hostile geopolitical environment with an increasingly revisionist large Russian Federation at our door, and inside Georgia, by the way, as well. Slogans, roses, flags, and policy papers, the tools we used as opposition and civil society leaders, would no longer suffice. What could we do? Were we just going to replace the old generation with a new one, basically do the same things over and over again? Or were we going to stay true to our dreams and to the dreams of all our people who bravely came into the streets to overthrow the previous regime? We took the risk of launching a quick, radical, and comprehensive reform process. What we lacked in experience, we made up for in spades in conviction and in a willingness to rigorously entertain new ideas. We are not constrained by dogma or dead weight of bureaucracies and powerful interest groups. Of course, we did not succeed in everything. We had significant shortcomings and we made quite some mistakes. But as the father of European cosmopolitanism, Immanuel Kant said 200 years ago, you cannot actually be free until you cannot be ready to be free until you actually are free. What Kant meant is that there is no book to teach you in advance how to operate within freedom. that you can learn it from your own successes and from your own failures, from trying to govern and behave in a free environment. He also meant that the pursuit of freedom brings uncertainty and risk, but that such risk should be seized if you want to be an actor in your life and in your nation's destiny. Kant was certainly right. In Georgia, we found no handbooks to guide us, and there will be no operating manual for our Arab friends as well. But there were experiences, successes, and failures that we could study and that we did study, before becoming in turn a case study as well. Today, regional policy and opinion makers, including Russians, as surprising as that might sound, come to Georgia in search of the ideas of new ways to address old problems. Most people who visit Georgia for the first time are surprised by the age of our ministers and senior government officials. We are, in fact, a Russian nation run in people in their late 20s, early 30s, and parliamentarians, core of young parliamentarians in mid-20s. This is both the result and the main driver of what the Economist recently characterized as Georgia's mental revolution. Georgians have stopped thinking of their country as a post-Soviet state. In fact, this is the first country among former Soviet states that stopped to be a post-Soviet state. This mental revolution goes far beyond the leaders and parties that led the Rose Revolution, far beyond the leadership. It is something that nobody owns, nobody can suppress, neither us or certainly not anybody else. I'm speaking here about a change of paradigms, again, want to underline it, about the mental revolution. Our first comprehensive reform was the complete transformation of our law enforcement bodies. We started by firing our entire traffic police force and then basically almost all existing policemen. Later, almost all existing customs officials, tax officials. Georgians lived for 3 months without traffic police, and amazingly, during this very period, when we had no traffic police and we had only 1/10 of criminal police left, crime rate went down. Why? Not only because police was responsible for most of the crimes, but also because people felt that they were part of a common adventure, that they had a stake, that they were living this very specific moment of our nation's history, when everything seems possible, when values become the basis of politics, when you have the feeling of inventing your own future. Keeping this feeling alive is a difficult but essential task. For the leader of a country, in post-revolution transformation, institutions are still not strong enough to resist a wave of disappointment and cynicism in the public. We knew that we needed and still need more than just a passive acceptation from the people. We needed and we still need them to be an active part of the transition process. And here is the key. There is no thing that in a smart leadership, technocratically minded, you know, very well educated, knowing what they want, there is no way they can make a change if the public is not part of it. We knew, so, and thanks to this radical change in our police and in all our other bureaucratic structures, and thanks to this widespread feeling among people that they owned these transformations, we have made greater progress on Transparency International Corruption Index since 2003 than any other nation in the world. And I still think that transparency is always downgrading us, by the way. It looks different from Berlin when they are stationed. We have built a highly favorable investment climate based on 3 key principles: minimal regulation, low taxes, and I just mentioned strong anti-corruption enforcement. Georgia is a small nation, remote from commercial centers and financial capitals, located in mildly described as a shaky geopolitical environment. Our only chance of attracting investors was to become a regional haven. We are now ranked as one of the easiest places in the world to do business. According to the World Bank, no other country had progressed since these ratings had been documented. in the world as Georgia did. Actually, we're the easiest place in Eastern and Central Europe to do business. Before the invasion of 2008 and the world crisis, we had considered double-digit growth. We had consistent double-digit growth and a testament to the depth and soundness of our economic reform. And this, despite a contraction in 2009, FDI-driven economy, and the FDI-driven economy for its double nightmare, world crisis and the real full-fledged war with the nuclear superpower. And we still had only 3.8 contraction in 2009. And we were back with 6.7% growth last year. And this year, in January, February, we have a growth that is around 9%. There is still a lot to be done, obviously, and we are more committed than ever to pursuing our perfect reforms to keep building a democracy at a gunpoint. Constructing sustainable civil institutions, building an effective civic education system, and nurturing competent citizens in a challenge that takes more than 7 years. As you know, two Georgia regions, around 20% of our territory, two-thirds of our seacoast, the most beautiful part of Georgia, is under foreign occupation. There has been extensive coverage of this fact since 2008. We have in a country of less than 5 million people, 500,000 internally displaced persons. There were once three regions of Georgia that were artificially separated from the rest of the nation. One of them was peacefully liberated. Today, while South Ossetia and Abkhazia are isolated from the world, Adjara, the third region, has become the centerpiece of new Georgian economy. New Singapore, Dubai, with democracy of the world. Over the last several years, Adjara's capital, the seaside resort of Batumi, has received $4 billion in private investment for a population of less than 200,000. They have more five-star brand hotels and names, Hyatt, Sheraton, Ritz-Carlton, Kempinski, you just named them. They have more of them than the city of Moscow. I'm sure that all regions in Georgia, including the currently occupied ones, would someday benefit from such torrid development. People in our region might have believed for a long time that their only choice was between Yeltsin type of chaos, democratic, albeit democratic, but still chaos, and Yeltsin type of authoritarian stability. A Putin type of authoritarian stability. Georgia, ladies and gentlemen, has shown that another path was possible. It has created another model for this region. I certainly do not pretend that our model is perfect. And you know, by the way, I mean, I'm not a big watcher, and neither is our population, fortunately, of Russian television. But we have these two trends in Russia. We have official media that describes Georgia as an absolute evil, the main threat to existence of great nation of Russia. Those people who believe Russian propaganda believe that there are 60, 70 million Georgians around. They are all around. They dominate all the aspects of life, and they are the main menace that this nation of Russia faces. And there is much smaller but more and more active and vocal Russian opposition media that describes Georgia in the terms that is very much reminiscent of what we thought of in my childhood of America under Ronald Reagan. Absolute ideal. Paradise on the earth. No criticism was accepted. I would, you know, smash the face of anybody in my yard when I would go down as a school child who would ever criticize America. And we are hearing this about Georgia. Now, if you are a Georgian average guy and you watch Russian television, they watch it, by the way, less and less, but whatever, I mean, out of curiosity. Of course you are pissed off by this bad depiction of your country, but certainly you are also equally irritated by the fact that they describe it as paradise on the earth, because we live in our country and we know that it's very far from ideal. But that tells you the story. That basically, of course, these are two extremes. But Georgia is much bigger than a country, plus a country that's 20% of it is occupied, which people not, it's not always easily catches the eye for if you're looking from Washington. It's much bigger than a country for the region. You had the other day Rosa Otarbayeva, the president of Kyrgyzstan, speaking at Carnegie Foundation, and basically at length speaking that she's learning to from Georgia reforms. We basically have a new profession now at our ministries, a profession, you know, ministerial tourist guides. That's to say minister from Ukraine, Moldova, Kyrgyzstan, Armenia, Russia, not ministers, but quite some important people, coming and learning from reforms. And we trained our officials to teach them. And they are saying it openly that they are learning from Georgian experience, as well as we were learning from Estonia, great nation of Estonia, which is five times smaller than Georgia, but basically very interesting to learn from. We just had our group of ministers sent to Singapore to see their pension models. We are not willing to outlaw the chewing gums, but and certainly our stability, to put it more seriously, is based on popular consent. And we are in 21st century, no big wonder. But still interesting things to pick up from there as well. And certainly, as I said, I do not pretend this model is perfect, and we still have a long way to go before achieving our objectives. And even if people are coming, not that this model is necessarily transferable to other countries. But I would like to believe that this kind of transformation reveals some universal truths. And I will finish with them, as I see them. The recent revolutions have shown us that the universal strive for freedom of people across the globe is the true motor of history. And that the only realistic policy on the long term is a policy that supports that strive, that promotes these values that America embodies better than any other country in the world. I would like to end here by referring to this great figure of American history, my very good friend Richard Holbrooke. Perhaps the best friend I've ever had in this town. Dick was as pragmatic as one can get, and at the same time, incarnation of an idealist. He was a true believer and a great diplomat. The recent events validate his vision of the world, this vision that he shared so many times with me, that is not so much then now so much needed, a profound love for freedom, and an absolute awareness of the risk it implies. You know, real politics guys think they're smart. They get it. They clean politics from real, you know, from all this idealist crap. And then they will get the point. And the main thing, impediment to damn big country being successful is like getting rid of idealists without understanding that that's exactly where the demise of American power lies. Basically, being real political, you cannot outsmart other big powers. Nor America's economic leverage, neither its just military power would not be enough just to have America's role, unless we understand that it's only just 20% of America's power, and the rest 80% is based on perception of ideals, perception of there is somebody out there in this pretty small town of Washington that shares the same ideals and values. And I think Richard Holbrooke understood this and nobody else. And I think that profound love for freedom and an absolute awareness of the risk it implies is ultimately victorious policy. That's to say, idealist without naivety. Thank you so much, and I'm open for crushing debate.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much, President Saakashvili. Before we begin with the discussion, I'd actually like to make an apology to everyone who is here, that unfortunately we couldn't get a larger room for such a wonderful event as today. As you can see, Mr. President, we have standing room only, and many of the people who are standing at the back are some of our most distinguished participants in Brookings events. We also, in fact, have another room where they can see us, but unfortunately we cannot see them, and I can't bring them into the discussion. where another larger group of people are there. So I think you can really see here the resonance of the topic that sure. you have brought to us today. And we have a number of people representing the U.S. government here in the audience, and I want to make sure that I can call on as many people as possible. We have until, I believe, about 3:15 when you have to go. And if there's any need to end a little earlier, I will look to your ambassador, who I'd also like to acknowledge here. Timur Yakubashvili, for many people in the room, you will know him from, in fact, academia and the think tank world. Timur Yakubashvili, like President Saakashvili, has a long and distinguished history here in the United States and was a Yale fellow where he met Strobe Talbott. And has, of course, also been very much a member of the think tank community before his government service. And we're very pleased to welcome him here, too, as well as all the other members of your delegation, who many of us know personally. There's a couple of questions I want to put to you, just to put this again in the context of the Middle East before we turn to all of our colleagues here. You touched upon a lot of very important yeah. issues when people are looking at Egypt. And, of course, this is a real topic of conversation here at Brookings and elsewhere in town right now. One of the big debates about the Middle East as to how to move from revolutionary to evolutionary policy once the initial phases are over. And that's obviously something that you've given considerable thought to. And as you mentioned, it's only been 7 years, and it's difficult to make that transition in that time. And I wonder if you might share some perspectives on that. The other issue, as you stressed, rightly so, the youth of the Georgian government, and in fact the revolutions in the Middle East are made by the youth. This is not a revolution even of people in their 40s. This is very much the people in their 20s and early 30s. And then there's a great debate now in Egypt and elsewhere about youth over experience as one moves into the government. People like Amr Moussa, Al-Baradei and others who are potentially running for president in Egypt, and other questions about whether a more youthful or a new generation can come to the fore. And finally, the other really big question in the Middle East contest is the one that you stressed at the very end, and one of the reasons I believe that you're here right now in Washington, which is the issue of jobs and investment, which are tied together. You've been here for various meetings on the Georgian economy. You've talked about the level of investment that you've managed to secure in Ajara and elsewhere in Georgia. But creating jobs is perhaps one of the biggest secrets to success for the future, as you know only too well. And it's going to be a really big dilemma for the Middle East. And so I wonder if you could touch on three of those issues, and then we'll bring in the rest of our colleagues.
Well, I mean, what happened really in Georgia, and that's something remarkable, the reason why I also said that in a way it's first post-Soviet society, because this is the only former Soviet republics, and with all due respect to our friends in Baltic countries, that were basically the oldest members of my government are me and our ambassador here. And actually, because we still remember the Soviet Union, in bad ways, I mean, Timur was a young Jewish activist who was jailed last time in the late 80s for staging an embassy against Syria, demonstration against Syrian embassy in Moscow. I was investigated by KGB when I was first year student at Kiev University for anti-Soviet activities, but we remember it. Although I was 50 year student when it got disintegrated, so I never got the experience of working under Soviets. But we have ministers in our 20s that don't even remember how Soviet Union looked. They never wore pioneer ties. And that's the key to change, actually, because in many ways, biblical myth of Moses is a real one. I mean, actually, you need the whole change of generation to move away from that old system. And that's why I think the best asset we have in our government at every level are young people. And that creates friction. That creates friction between generations. And, my grandmother is still around and she's not happy, or my parents that, you know, there is this thing that, you know, young people have taken over everything. But that's actually, I think, it's happened naturally. It happened naturally because there is this new ideology in place, which, I mean, way of life. It's not even ideology, that you need to be very innovative and you need to be young. And I think from that point of view, Middle East has much bigger asset. But the biggest challenge is that with revolutions is that you get people in the street who feel empowered,
and they think that they can do just anything, and they can claim just anything. So it's always nice to watch when, you know, just newly appointed prime minister goes out to the crowds and tell them, if you are not pleased, I will, you know, resign again. You know, that's how it is. But in fact, when it goes to real governance, it moves away from waving flags and from, you know, we had revolution that looked like rock concert. And then you go to everyday job. And we know that reformers are always competing against the time. Window of opportunity for reform is limited. It can be shut down very fast. And it's always competition against the time and against the expectations. I mean, you have amazing... I mean, people in Egypt, like people in Georgia, we had President Chevardnadze, who ruled Georgia for 30 years as a Communist Party head and then as president. And everybody thought he was eternal. So people, because they thought he was so eternal, they thought they could depose him and they could do just anything. But, you know, then it goes to a hard job of governing, and that gets very hard. And it's, I think, on the one hand, it's true that we were in easier situation because we had already experienced group of reformers that also had government experience. Egyptians are getting to elections way too soon. I heard many skeptical voices also in this town saying it's too soon for elections. But on the other hand, you cannot have big gap because people need to see the results. People need to see the real transformation. Because the biggest challenge revolution gives is impatience of the people in the street with changes. And I remember when we took over, the treasure was empty, but we faced this amazing, first of all, amazing love of the people because they put in us every dream they had. They thought we were their incarnation of those dreams, and it's very dangerous. And but then I thought to myself in 2004, if we could raise our tax collection by 40%, by 30% actually, by within a year, then I would think we made it. We doubled tax collection for Sears, and overall, if we think that we decreased tax by 65%, we increased tax collection by overall 30 times over the last few, several years. But, of course, it's never enough. But you should always move. As I mentioned, we fired the entire police force. We basically changed 95% plus of bureaucracy over the years. And you should always be ready that, you know, it's going to hurt you because... As far as I understand, in Egypt, for instance, there are lots of entrenched interests, also for the army. And if you are willing to compromise with entrenched interests, you are in trouble. You need to go and, you know, like, understand that it's like clean slate and you are starting from the scratch and there are no special interests there. You are not obliged to anybody. You are rebuilding from the scratch. And obviously, you know, once you don't exile your opponents to concentration camps, they will be around for a while. And they'll be always willing to hit back at you at every mistake you make. And you should be prepared for that as well. And you should, you know, most of the people we fired live in downtown capital, in Georgia. Many of them still carry strong grudge against us. And every time there is a rally, it's easy recruits for people, anybody. I mean, they just don't have to walk from their houses to get to Main Street for, you know, hate rally, not just a protest rally. Because we destroyed their livelihoods. But I can tell good news is that Egypt is a much bigger country than Georgia. And I think reforms are much easier to implement in bigger country than a small one. Because, you know, look at where we were in Georgia. Georgia had an elite that was elite not only of this small country, but it was elite as minimum of the Caucasus. That is to say the place that has like up to 20 million people. But it was as much of an elite of, like, or very much part of the elite of former Russian Empire since 200 years, and before that, Persian Empire, Ottoman Empire, they were very classy in that respect, when they were under different empires. And suddenly they found themselves in this small country, and they were, you know, they thought that they had all this entitlement. Now, if you go against special interests, as we did, then you harm your neighbor, your cousin, your previous, you know, voter, supporter, whatever. If you're a country of 80 million people, it's easier. You don't have to go, you know, you don't meet everyday people in that country whose interests you harmed. You might avoid to do that. So anyway, if you really go for it, it's once you start the mechanism, it's easier because there are lots of alternatives to, you know, look for. And from that point of view, big reforms are much more possible in Egypt than they ever were in Georgia. I mean, they have other handicaps, obviously. We are all aware of them, but, I mean, they can still make it.
Thank you. That's very, very insightful. There's a number of questions here. I'll take maybe two or three from the front, and then I will move to the back. My eyesight is just about good enough to see everyone back there. So another one in the third row here, and there was someone over here. Yes, Steve Sistanovich. So.
Hi,
and please introduce yourselves,
yes, sure,
too.
Sure. Thank you. Thanks for doing this. My name is Andrei Sitov. I'm a Russian reporter in Washington, D.C. I'm sorry, but I'll ask a reporter's question. Can you talk about your current visit to the U.S., what you wanted to achieve, what you have achieved, what you talked about with Strauss-Kahn today? And are you meeting President Obama or Vice President Biden? If not, why not? Thank you.
Let me take another question behind. Tom Duval and then Steve Sistanovich, who is sitting here.
Yes, hello. I'm Tom Duval from the Carnegie Endowment. Mr. President, I want to ask you about how sustainable your economic model is. There are many successes in the Georgian economy, but you're in a difficult patch at the moment. You yourself have said unemployment is 30% in Tbilisi, and inflation is very high. FDI was down last year. What is your long-term economic model, particularly to create jobs and to attract more FDI? And in particular, you've had given some mixed messages about European Union, how close you want to get to Brussels. You talk about Singapore, and you also talk about Europe. Can you tell us about that? Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. And a question over here from Steve Sistanovich.
I'm Steve Sistanovich from Columbia University and the Council on Foreign Relations. Mr. President, I wonder whether you could give some advice not just to the Middle Eastern countries, but to the United States, in thinking about how to use its influence. A lot of people here are wondering how public the United States should be in pushing for greater reform, for a faster revolutionary pace. Can you, from your own experience perhaps, talk a little bit about whether it's most useful for the United States to be a public critic, to push harder, even to challenge people who have been its friends, or is it better to work behind the scenes? How can the United States help to move these revolutions forward?
Thank you. Maybe I could. Yeah. First of all, I met President Obama twice for the last couple of months, starting from Lisbon summit in December and then again in January here in Washington. So this time I had much more relaxed trip and much more fun in terms that, you know, Georgian company signed a deal with Donald Trump that would involve raising $350 million for real estate deal in our Seacoast town. I just met a couple of days ago for another, the big world's biggest share apartment kind of owners that are developing three or four projects in Georgia. Obviously, I met with Strauss-Kahn, and we are ending program with IMF, so actually we just want them to stay on standby, but they played a very useful role, and I thanked him for his leadership in previous years. With regard to our economy, look at the macroeconomics. You know, Georgia's growth in January, February was around 9%. Our currency has been appraising despite the trade deficit, and that's telling me that Georgia is really becoming a hub. Money is coming from all directions. If you ask me from there, where they are coming, they are certainly not coming from U.S. or, you know, Japan, well, with all due respect to Japanese, and for all the tragedy that happened there, I'm going today to the Japanese embassy. They are coming to from the region. And they are, and you know, if you ask me who are these investors, I don't know. There are lots of them. There are lots of people who have $1-3 million and they want to invest in Georgia. And that's an amazing thing because actually it's much better than, you know, the fact that we are ranked as world's number one reformer, number one fighter with corruption. These people know it from the word of the mouth, not from the our publicity pages, ads from you know, New York Times or FT, and or the Economist of London. And the currency has been strengthening. It's sure a sign of, and it's not so good for exports, but money is coming in. I've been talking about Singapore, and I am not shy of it, because actually we should contribute to Europe what we are best at. We are undeniably an European nation. Actually, two biggest achievements of civilization come from Georgia tradition. This is medicine and wine. Medicine comes from Georgian queen of Medea. And you certainly need it once you drink, after you drink lots of wine. and for headache at least. And actually, we are undeniably European country, and I think that eventually we'll be a country that will be not so far away, candidate for European Union membership. But when we are talking about Singapore, we don't mean that, as I said, that we are banning chewing gums or we'll appoint parliament members. But we are looking at their pension funds very carefully. We're looking at the way how they stimulate investment in different fields of economy through some kind of incentives that the government gives and through liberal economics. We are looking at them as being, you know, in a very hostile geopolitical environment. Remember, we are not bordering Norway and Sweden or Denmark like some of our good Baltic friends. We are in different environment, and that's why we have to look at Singapore. And I think, as I said, our stability is based on popular consent rather than, you know, we control everything and we are like, we have another tradition, and you cannot try to achieve your steady growth through neglecting or not asking what your citizens think about it. But it's an interesting model, and and that's what we are contributing to Europe. We are at that borderline of civilizations. That's why when we hear about clash of civilizations, I never accept it, because we have elements of different civilizations in Georgia, and they coexist very well. And that's why I think that this also should be integrated into economic model. We cannot afford not to have liberal economics, because that's our principal asset. On the other hand, we should build an European democracy, because it's a long-term guarantee for stability. And those two don't contradict each other, or at least I think economic crisis, they should have taught Europe that lesson, that those two don't contradict each other. That's the way I see it. And with regards to the U.S., I think, everything America says counts. And you know, there's lots of discussion of whether America should bomb this or other target, or whether they should have a no-fly zone or something. This is up to the Americans to decide it. But what I know for sure is that at the time of trouble, and, you know, we've not experienced any American military intrusions or, you know, whatever strong other moves, but what we've experienced at the time of trouble, that every word pronounced here in Washington counts. And every uncareful word might harm, and every encouraging support might be very decisive. And, you know, I would say, if you talk about American might, 20% of it is a real hardcore power, military power, economic leverage. 80% is perception of America being special. And I've heard also voices in Washington saying, oh, that doesn't count, you know, like, this is... But, you know, if you just compete in terms of just, you know, pure economic leverages or military, you might lose. Well, America is very special that it cares about faraway countries like Georgia, of which some of the other people have heard very little. And Georgia or Tunisia or Libya or whatever, Kyrgyzstan. And that, you know, and we are listening very carefully what every American opinion maker has to do, make as a statement, has to think. And, you know, if I had been you, which I'm not obviously, but I wouldn't have wanted to really get rid of that part of my leverage. And I think that's why it's essentially very important. You know, we certainly, even if somebody, sometimes American policymakers are just like, sound like, and it concerns, you know, any politician. It's not, I'm not talking necessarily about government, but even somebody in at Congress or at even a think tank would speak about the events as if they're just watching CNN and commenting on that. But that has lots of relevance for those faraway places. And I think, you know, I've traveled extensively to Middle East as a tourist before and as president recently. But even as president, I go out to streets. I like to have tea at a street cafe. I like to go to shopping centers, to explore around, you know, interact with people. And one thing I had noticed is before all these events is that people immediately recognize me. If I walk around the Tyson Corners in Washington, that wouldn't be the case. There they do. And they know everything about Georgian politics, as well as they know about Japanese politics, U.S. politics. Why? Because there is lack of local politics there.
Mm-hmm.
And that reminds me very much of how we were in the Soviet Union. We were like, when I was 9-year-old kid, I knew everything about Joshua Nkomo and Mugabe, about, you know, conflict they have with each other. I knew everything about, you know, whatever, you know, like primary debates were at New Hampshire here in the U.S. or anything. I mean, because we didn't have any domestic politics, because that's how we fed our fantasy, because it's a human instinct to be interested in public life. And so, actually, that's clearly telling me that those people there, they're ready for public life. And I don't believe they're anti-American. They have natural skepticism of some, you know, of America, but, you know, it's really being shaped now. You know, their impression of America will be shaped for the next 50 years of how America acts now. And this is a historic opening and chance for this country. And I understand clearly the fatigue with politics. I understand the fatigue because of the economic crisis. But, you know, ultimately, there is no way you can abstain from it anyway because it's there. It's not like somewhere else. It's part of what you are. And I think that from that point of view, people do get it. I mean, I had very limited interaction this time, but I met with Senate leadership yesterday. I had some interaction with think tankers or journalists, other opinion makers, and I think people get it because it's still ultimately that's the place to which people come for justice and for at least some vindication. You know, look, if you are an embattled country like we are, aspiring one but embattled with all the issues out there, fighting for its existence, you know, you care a lot if there's somebody else in the world who thinks you are on the right side. Not just you think that you are, but somebody else does. And especially if these people are in Washington, that has an absolutely magnifying effect for everything. And please never give up this power to influence things in good direction, even through your kind word. It's an amazing power you've been blessed with. That's all I can say.
Thank you. There were a couple of hands right at the very back that I'd like to take because everyone is standing there. If we could just collect three questions from the back, please, and then we'll turn back to the president. Thank you.
Hello. My name is Tatia Lemonjava. I'm a master's student at SAIS Johns Hopkins University. Thank you for your very interesting speech. It is crucial for a young democracy like Georgia to identify and sort of take advantage of its economic resources, and you yourself highlighted that. Strategic geological geopolitical position of Georgia is such that it can transport natural gas and oil from the Caspian Basin and from the Central Asian republics to Europe. How do you see that landscape changing in the future, and do you see any hydroelectric power or other alternative resources also entering into the picture in the future? Thank you.
Thanks. And there was another question right here, this lady. Yeah. Please introduce yourself.
Melinda Herring, Georgetown University. Mr. President, I'm sure that you know American history better than I do. American historians point to the peaceful transition between Washington and John Adams as a point of democratic consolidation. What are your thoughts on 2012, and can we expect to see you again soon?
And another question right at the back there. I think that's Ian Brzezinski, I think I see from there.
Yes, Ian Brzezinski. I'm a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. Welcome to Washington, Mr. President, and thank you for your remarks. Could I ask you to share your perceptions and understandings of what is happening in the Russian Caucasus to your north? I have the impression it's Russian? A region.
Ian, could you repeat that? Did you say Russian policies towards
Russian,
Georgia?
What is the situation? How does he view situation in the Russian Caucasus?
Oh, in the Russian Caucasus.
Ingushetia. One has the impression it's become increasingly violent, a collision between groups that are using terrorist means and increasingly brutal and repressive responses by the Kremlin. What are the implications of that region for the 2012 elections in Russia, for democracy in Russia, for the 2014 Olympics in Sochi, and for your region's security? Is this an issue that should be raised by the United States and its European allies in the dialogue with Russia? Thank you.
Well, yes, with regard to the first question on hydropower, actually, Georgia has three amazing potentials for the years to come to grow. Tourism, that's to say we had 2 million. When I became president, we had 124,000 tourists a year before that. Last year we had 2 million. This year we'll have 3 million. And I hope that we'll have between 8 and 10 million in 3 years from now under our modernization program, 4 years from now. And that's wild growth. Second is agriculture, where crops could be easily quadrupled, but that's meaning we want to double them within the next 2-3 years. And third wind is hydropower. We are utilizing only less than 20% of our hydropower potential. We cover almost 100% of our needs. Remember when I became president, we used to import 80% of our energy from Russia. Then Russia declared full-blown energy embargo on us. And then we basically now the only commodity we sell to Russia, the only thing we sell to Russia is hydropower. And we will, and I think lots of jobs will be generated for years to come by hydropower construction, and then lots of other jobs, industrial jobs, will be generated from using that relatively cheap and safe way to power your plants. By the way, you know, one of the things we are doing now, we just signed a memorandum today in France that saying that we'll move all our cars, all our government to electric cars, and that's another way because actually it's cheaper now in Georgia. We don't have to subsidize. It's 30% cheaper than all, you know, petrol, gas-powered cars. And actually, that's a very noble quest to have. With regard to transition, I think Georgia has already had started the process of transition. We have elected the mayor of the capital, which amounts for 1/4 of the country directly. But we also have local elections everywhere for city council elected, and basically we also have Autonomous Republic of Ajara, where local council is elected by the population. Overall, at least 1/3 in terms of direct elections are beyond the control of the of the president. And under the new constitution changes, and I cannot run for presidency again, the president remains very powerful because actually he has regulatory power, and that's a very significant part of our decentralized government, regulatory commissions. And I was the one who insisted that, against the recommendation of the European experts, by the way, the Venice Commission, that president should have kept strong powers. Of course, he is still in charge of foreign policy, and he is in charge of security policy, but he also runs a significant part of daily executive government under the new constitution. Prime Minister would be appointed by Parliament, and Prime Minister will be important, more important than under today's constitution. because it's directly reports to the parliament and it's appointed by parliamentary majorities. But my prediction would be that prime ministers would be to change much faster than, much more frequently than the presidents. Now, I think right now in Georgia every institution is more popular than the institution holder. It's a very important change, but their institutions are still weak. And certainly one thing I would not like to get, especially because we are now moving parliament to second biggest city of Georgia, and that's an important psychological, political, social change. We are moving to this parliamentary government. We are doing lots of small and big reforms that count. And the last thing my country needs is a lame duck president that will have no option whatsoever for the future political life. And that will not be very Jeffersonian or Washingtonian at the time when we have to build still those strong institutions. Certainly my country will move beyond personalities and will be a performing democracy, and it's also already going that way. By the way, we have a good consultation now with several political parties from the opposition, new election code. Previous elections were deemed as a big step forward, but we want to make ideal elections. We don't only want to be number one reformers or number one fighters with corruption, but we want to have the cleanest elections. If you no longer allow to steal public goods, you should also exclude any doubt that public vote would be stolen. And that's pretty achievable with the climate we have. That's the second question. With regards with what Ian Brzezinski had asked about the Russian Caucasus. Look, there is a wonderful book by British author from the 60s. I think it's called White Sabres, about the Caucasian War in the 19th century. That was won through alliance of Russians with Georgian aristocracy and generals and military in the 19th century. So this was a joint effort of two Christian nations against the resurgence, Muslim resurgence at that moment in Northern Caucasus. One thing is clear from that book. Every time, first Russia tried to tackle it through brutality of the King Nicholas I, very much reminiscent of the policies that are implemented today. Every time they thought it was over, it came back with new force. And then Alexander II came in and he introduced liberal reforms. And that's what basically extinguished the fire there. And I think that's a great historic example, that you cannot treat violence through violence, brutality through 10 times more brutality. It will come to haunt you again. And right now, it's out of control. You know, I've heard my counterpart, President Medvedev, blaming Georgia for possible problems for Sochi Olympics, but that's not a very encouraging sign. That means that they really don't know what the real symptoms show and what should be the cure. And they might go for a wrong cure and get even more of those symptoms that eventually might get them. So, you know, when I saw physically last time President Putin, he was president at that time still, 2008, February, he told me basically that they would fight war with us and they would recognize our Russian-dominated, at that time still separatist areas, because still then even separatists were mostly out from there. And when he told me that, I told him, and we had like lots of witnesses to that conversation. These are official talks in Moscow. I told him, Vladimir Vladimirovich, are you okay? You'll do it, but what about Northern Caucasus? How is it going to affect your Northern Caucasus if you are getting into this adventure just basically next door in areas that are very much related to Northern Caucasus? And he told me, you know, Northern Caucasus is over. It's finished. And even if eventually somebody shows up, we'll just, you know, get them and destroy them like cockroaches. You know, he made signs with finger, like how he would do it with, like, totally confident what he's doing. So I guess now there are too many of those cockroaches out there. And one finger doesn't suffice to suppress all of them. And even 10 fingers wouldn't suffice to all of them. And actually, that's instructive for all of us. That, you know, if you cannot play with those things, You know, people are people everywhere. They react to certain things, and you know, and I think people in Northern Caucasus, they are very normal people. You know, we liberalized visa regime for them. We allowed to come into Georgia without visas. We already had 90,000 of them. We expect this year something like 400,000 of them coming in. So far, we didn't have a single minor incident with these people. They are very law obedient when they come to a country which has rule of law, smiling policemen, no corruption, good opportunities to spend their Kremlin sent cash for. And so, you know, if you are looking at those people, they're very normal. Obviously, we are not getting some of the hardcore ones. But, you know, I don't think it's worth antagonizing those people. They are people just any other, like any other people. They just need to be treated as such, as humans. And then I think many problems will be taken care of automatically.
We have time, perhaps one more group of questions. There was two people who were putting their hands down here, and then I'll take this lady here. And I'm sorry to everyone else, but the president will have to go. So over here, Richard White.
I'm Richard White, Hudson Institute. You've talked a bit about relations with Russia and the United States and North Caucasus. What about your relations with your own neighbors in the South Caucasus and Central Asia? Are they going well? Any lagging areas? For example, we've been impressed that none of them have recognized the independence of Abkhazia or South Ossetia, but certainly in some areas you'd like to see improvements.
Thank you. And over here, Bill Courtney.
Hi, Bill Courtney, former U.S. ambassador in Georgia. Good to see you again, Mr. President. Since the color revolution, since the Rose Revolution, Georgia truly has made some magnificent accomplishments, and the Transparency International improvement is a good sign of that. Yet, at the same time, Freedom House still ranks Georgia as only partially free, and I think that probably reflects a fair consensus of experts in Western Europe and the United States. Do you think that's a misperception, or have there been persistent shortcomings in democratic development that have caused the problem?
Thank you. And there was this lady here. Thank you.
Anna Mirzashvili, Georgian, an undergraduate student from Denison University and currently interning at Senator Lugar's office. First of all, I would like to say that I'm proud to have a president like you. And our country is definitely on a successful path during your presidency towards democracy and westernization. My question is about the education reform that took in our country. And I have a specific question about the project of Teach and Learn with Georgia, which I believe is a project of 1,000 English native English-speaking teachers coming to the Georgian schools and teaching English. I have many American friends who are willing to participate in this project after the graduation. So I'm wondering to know whether this project is a short term or it's going to continue in the future as well. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you all for the questions. With regards to our neighbors, we have perfect relations with both of them. As I said, Armenian presidents have been saying continuously they should learn from Georgia in terms of reforms. We have done the drive-through borders. You don't even get checked. Most of them can drive through. We are coordinating on tariffs policies. We are easing we have transportation commissions with both of them. We have lots of other ties. And it's really the integration is happening in both ways. I think we should be continuation of each other with Azerbaijan. We are continuation of each other with Armenia. And by the way, we also have amazing relations with Turkey. We have several border passing points opening. We have visa-free and now passport-free travels coming from May, like it used to be between Canada and the U.S. prior to bad events in 2011. I'm looking forward to the time when Caucasus will be one united itself and this problem will be solved out. There is no alternative to that. With regards to what Bill asked, partially free, Georgia has actually went up on Freedom House rankings last year in terms of civil liberties. I hope once we proceed towards elections 2012, we'll get upgraded even more. But, it's a three-sided effort. On the one hand, government, opposition, but also NGOs that are giving information to Freedom House that are interacting with them, as you well know. And, you know, we are already used to that. We are held accountable to higher standards than average. We are used to that. That's how it is. And you know as well as I do, for all the different reasons in the world, for geopolitical reasons, for people that, you know, people want to look at us with us, you know, with magnifying glasses to look for faults, maybe why they wouldn't help us. That's fine. We're not ideal. We have a long way to go. And I'm very calm about that. You know, we will eventually get there. I think we'll get there within my term of my presidency when all of them recognize and upgrade us. But that's how it is. And, you know, that's... and by the way, I mean, getting back to, like, third question, I'm very pleased to have that we have more and more Georgians in this town. At the moment when I was doing my doctoral research here and used to ride bicycles around this place, there were one or two, three or four persons max of us around, and much more now. And also, by the way, besides the people who are getting there themselves, we also had a presidential program for scholarships, and we sent something like 460 roughly people to study in the U.S. with our limited means. But we'll do this. We invited, basically, this program is 10,000 for 10,000, mostly predominantly Americans, to teach English in Georgia. And it's an amazing program. These people basically are stationed. We already have like 1,600 of them. They are stationed in every small rural area. And the change of culture, you get young American women or men coming in a small rural areas, small, some remote mountainous village. And the other day I met by accident in a bar a young guy who was at some remote mountainous village, and he told me, look, I do my jogging every morning in that village, and you know, nobody has ever seen anybody jogging early in the morning, you know, really. And with my iPod, and then I'm chased by dogs. But that's really a whole change of culture. It's amazing. It's much more than the language does. You know, we did now this thing that we push law through regulation, through regulatory commission, that we do film movies with subtitles. And frankly, most of the people think it's my personal whim to do movies with subtitles. But, you know, I've lived in France, and I've been to Netherlands many times, and I know in Netherlands they have films with movies with subtitles, and they speak English. In France, they don't, and they don't speak English. as we all know, they speak French, strangely so. I think one of the main reasons it's different is this movie business. And, you know, so it's a very complex program for us. So actually, we'll continue with this program. We want more of them out there jogging in our neighborhoods and in our villages. We need to change. We need to adapt. We need to... And, you know, it's not like these 10,000 people, they will not only bring America to Georgia, to doorsteps of every Georgian, multi-ethnic nation of Georgia. That's how I usually prefer to say it. And that's what one of the proudest achievements we've got, that I'm never referring to Georgia as Georgians per se. It's like multi-ethnic and nation of called Georgia, multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multi-cultural. But also, eventually, they will become Georgian ambassadors to the outside world, especially to this country. We have now a very good ambassador here. We have getting very, you know, maybe better facilities for the embassy, but we'll need not one, but maybe several thousand ambassadors here to make our case. I know America is one and the world is too big and America is overstretched and it's hard to keep focus. And so we need our own internal army to infiltrate this great country to keep its attention focused on us. That's all I can say. Thank you so much for inviting.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks a lot.